Today, we're going to take a brief look at some central questions connected with the way Christians reflect on human being, or the topic of theological anthropology. Theological anthropology is made up of two key terms: anthropology, which simply means the study of humanity. However, anthropology by itself can be approached from a variety of different angles. There's physical anthropology, cultural anthropology, philosophical anthropology, economic anthropology, all different perspectives, different lenses that can be used to explore the topic of human being. Theological anthropology looks specifically at human beings in relation to God. That is, how those from a particular faith tradition explore the question of humanity. The central question of theological anthropology, at least in Christian perspective, is that of what does it mean to be human, or what is distinctive about human being in relationship to all the other kinds of creatures in the world. While there are a variety of biblical texts that can be invoked to help to focus reflection on this topic from a Christian perspective, the one that has been by far the most influential comes at the very beginning of the Christian Bible in the first chapter of Genesis, specifically verses 26 and 27, where it is recorded that God wanted to and did create human beings in the image of God, or according to the Latin phrase, the imago Dei. Christian theological reflection on human being, Christian theological anthropology, has, on the strength of this passage, tended to focus heavily on trying to identify the content of this image, on the grounds that if it can be determined, that will help to provide the definitive answer to what it means to be human, what is distinctive about human beings. The difficulty is that the passage in Genesis doesn't offer an explicit definition of the term, and so Christians have been left to reflect on what it might refer to, what the character of the image might be. And over the centuries, Christians have come up with a variety of responses to this question. We're going to look at three basic families, three categories of response, each of which discloses something specific, particular, about what it might mean to be human, but each of which also has certain liabilities. Probably the most influential, the most popular approach to the question of the image of God would be those that I have categorized as noetic interpretations. Noetic from the Greek word for mind or intellect, and noetic interpretations seek to address the question of the image of God, and thus what is distinctive about human being, by identifying a cognitive capacity. There have been a range of ways in which these capacities have been identified over the centuries. In the early church, the capacities of rationality, human reason, and freedom were particularly compelling. In more modern periods, self-transcendence has been invoked as being a particularly good way to think of what is distinctively Christian. Rationality, referring to human beings' ability to reason, to think, to explore and examine the world. Freedom, to human beings' capacity to explore the world in particular ways, to be not determined entirely by their nature, but to be able to develop themselves in ways that are that show spontaneity and provide flexibility in their encounters with the world. And self-transcendence, referring to human beings' self-consciousness, their capacity to reflect upon themselves and think about themselves as more than simply the sum of their parts. Now, there's no question that all three of these ways of thinking about what is distinctive about human being do identify genuinely distinctive features of what it means to be human. These are aspects of human being that strike us and that we depend upon and deploy frequently in thinking about ourselves and encountering one another. So in that sense, there is a good deal of common sense to them. Again, they're not specifically mentioned in Genesis or for that matter anywhere else in Scripture as constituting the divine image, but if the image is understood as that which is most distinctive of human being, and particularly that which, as the image of God, reflects something of divinity, you can see why these categories would have been attractive and continue to be attractive to many Christian thinkers. God is thought of as rational, as having an ability to construct a universe that is predictable and follows natural laws. God is understood as being free, having an ability to be spontaneous, and God is viewed as self-transcendent, being able as a personal agent to reflect on God's own being. Human beings created in God's image, it would seem, are plausibly thought to be distinctive in that they exercise these characteristics, which are valued and seen as central to God's own existence. Nevertheless, there have been several difficulties identified with this way of thinking about human distinctiveness. A crucial one is that it seems to sell the body rather short. We may well identify rationality, freedom, self-transcendence, and other such powers as being definitive of what it means to be human in certain respects, but of course our most natural encounter with human beings, both others and ourselves, is as embodied creatures. And yet, to think of human distinctiveness purely in terms of these cognitive capacities seems to leave the body out of account, and therefore to give a defective or deficient account of what it means to be human. Perhaps still more seriously, these categories, these qualities, are not equally present in all persons. We know that there are folk with various sorts of intellectual disabilities, and of course, even persons who have at one time in their lives exemplary manifestations of rationality, freedom, and self-transcendence can, through accident or simply through age, lose them. And the question becomes, if it is these capacities that define our humanity, do those who do not have or lose these capacities somehow become less human? And in fact, even apart from those questions, even among the normal population, if you will, it's pretty clear that people exercise and have these abilities to different levels. Einstein has a certain level of rationality, freedom, and self-transcendence, perhaps not equaled by other folk. Does that mean that it's possible to range people based on the ability they have to exhibit these qualities on a scale of increased and decreased humanity? Certainly over the history of the church and Western civilization more generally, those kinds of invidious hierarchicalizations have been used to question the humanity of women and persons of non-European descent. And so to the extent that humanity is identified with these kinds of qualities, certain difficult questions are raised about what it implies for how people exhibit or manifest humanity. Finally, a further difficulty that's been noted is that this account of human being is rather abstract. It's highly individualistic, a capacity that is internal to the individual and that is exercised or is conceived generally in rather ahistorical, again, disembodied terms. Insofar as human beings live in time and space in encounter with others, it then for might seem that to identify these sorts of radically individualized cognitive capacities as what's essential to humanity, again, doesn't take into account our actual experience of what it means to be human. And so while these noetic interpretations in their various forms have proved very popular over the history of the church, particularly in the modern era, the 20th and the 21st century, they have been increasingly subject to critique. Most recently, the most popular alternative have been relational interpretations. Now, relational interpretations have an initial advantage in that they seem to have, if not exactly proof in Genesis 1, nevertheless, the text in Genesis 1 arguably suggests something like a relational interpretation of the image of God in this respect. Genesis 1 speaks of God creating human beings in God's image, and then in the very next line says, male and female God created them, as though the understanding of what it means to be in God's image is to be male and female. That is, not simply to be an isolated individual with a certain set of capacities, but rather to be a human being alongside another human being, one who is different, but nevertheless still fully human. So that clue in Genesis 1 has been used as an occasion for thinking about what is distinctive about human beings as something to do with their interpersonal character, the way in which they exist in relation to one another. Strengths of this approach, beyond the biblical evidence that may support them, has to do with the idea that actually when we think about it, our sense of ourselves as agents, as free, rational, and self-transcendent, isn't something that we come up with on our own. Rather, we experience ourselves as agents, as eyes, only as we are in relationship with other human beings. We are eyes insofar as we address and are addressed by yous or thous. So that seems to be a way in which our distinctive humanity is bound up with other human beings. Furthermore, this way of understanding our humanity as co-humanity, as humanity with others, seems, in a way that the noetic interpretations did not, to be able to take much more seriously our status as embodied creatures who live in history, because our relationships with others are mediated bodily through touch, through sight, through hearing. And also mediated through time. We develop relationships and develop our own understanding of who we are as we interact with other human beings over a stretch in time and space as embodied individuals. So those seem to be also strong elements in favor of this way of interpreting what is distinctive about human beings. Finally, there's a way in which noetic interpretations, insofar as they focus on capacities that we exercise individually and, as it were, on our own, have a difficult time dealing with other people as actually productive to who we are as being human. Other people tend to be viewed as something of a threat, a distraction, those who interfere with our freedom or distract us from our exercise of our rational capacities. So in noetic context, the other becomes something of a threat. Again, this seems to be, to many, counterintuitive in terms of our understanding of how humans are or at least and should be. Within a relational interpretation of the Imago Dei, the neighbor doesn't have this characteristic. On the contrary, we need the neighbor, we need the other in order to be the kinds of human beings that we are. So, from these perspectives, relational interpretations have been viewed by many, particularly in the last 150 years or so, as having a distinct advantage over the more traditional noetic interpretations. But the relational models are themselves not without weaknesses. And the weaknesses are, in certain respects, actually rather similar to those of noetic interpretations. That is, our ability to be relational, while it involves other people, nevertheless still seems to involve some intrinsic capacities that we possess. Empathy, the ability to interact with others in certain ways. And here, too, it's pretty clear there are categories of persons who, for a variety of reasons, mental illness, exhibiting certain behaviors on the autism spectrum, aren't able to interact with other human beings well. And in fact, in certain cases, are unable to perform and maintain stable human relationships. So once again, the question arises, do these incapacities, these inabilities, have impacts on how we judge their personhood? Are persons less human if they are unable to form relationships and maintain them in this way? Christians have generally wanted to say that isn't a problem, that human beings remain human even if they're unable to exhibit the capacities that may otherwise be understood as definitive of human beings in a strong and vibrant way. But it becomes difficult to see how that position can be maintained if humanity, if what is distinctive of human beings, if what defines us as human, is understood in terms of some intrinsic properties that we possess. In the face of these concerns, still a third category of interpretations of the image of God emerge: Christological interpretations. Christological interpretations take their basis from the idea that while Genesis speaks of human beings as created in God's image, thereby creating something of a distance between God's image and human beings. God's image is primary. Human beings reflect it to some extent. In the New Testament, Jesus of Nazareth, the one whom Christians confess to be the Christ, is actually defined as God's image in 1 Corinthians and Colossians. So we are in God's image. Jesus is God's image. On the basis of this, some theologians have suggested, well, we should understand our being in God's image as somehow or other our being like Jesus. And our likeness to Jesus in this way of thinking has to do with the fact that Jesus calls us to share in the life that he has with God. A strength of this way of thinking about human beings as created in God's image is that, in contrast to noetic and relational interpretations, our status as human beings now no longer depends on some capacity or ability that we exhibit or fail to exhibit. Our humanity is rather dependent on the fact that Jesus has summoned us, and in fact summoned us in our various different capacities, our various different ways of being human. So our humanity is now no longer defined intrinsically by some underlying property that we possess and therefore may possess in greater or lesser extent. Rather, it's defined extrinsically by an act that is done to us, namely Jesus calling us to fellowship with him and the God whom he proclaims. All people are thus arguably included in spite of any differences they may have. In fact, their differences are precisely what is enticing about them. Jesus calls them as the particular people they are in their diversity. In this respect, the Christological interpretations arguably have a strength, namely ability to be inclusive, that the other two categories do not have. Nevertheless, Christological interpretations have their own drawbacks. No solution to this problem is without its shortcomings. The one here has to do with the expansiveness of the framework within which humanity is conceived. One advantage shared by both noetic and relational interpretations is that while they are consistent with Christian experience and Christian belief about the way humanity is, as discussed in the Bible, they are not necessarily exclusive to that framework. So that being able to speak of humans as rational or free or defined by their interpersonal relationships provides a framework for talking about humanity that allows for easy crossover with members of other religious traditions, not only Judaism and Islam, the other Abrahamic faiths, but Hindus, Buddhists, and others as well, and for that matter, people who do not have a religious tradition that they claim. By contrast, Christological interpretations of the Imago Dei are clearly much more closely tied to specifically Christian claims. If humanity is known only in Jesus, it's hard to see how a theological anthropology constructed in these terms provides much of a basis for common ground or engagement with people who don't share Christian commitments. And so there's a major drawback to this perspective as well. Well, those are some brief considerations of three major approaches to this question. I now leave you with some questions that are related to this topic, which you will be asked to address as part of your assessment. Thank you very much.